Tom swept his brush daintily back and forth, stepped back to note the effect, added a touch here and there, criticized the effect again, Ben watching every move and getting more and more interested, more and more absorbed. Presently he said, "Say, Tom, let me whitewash a little." Tom considered, was about to consent, but he altered his mind. No, I reckon it wouldn't hardly do, Ben. You see, Aunt Polly's awful particular about this fence, right here on the street, you know. But if it was in the back fence, I wouldn't mind, and she wouldn't. Yes, she's awful particular about this fence. It's got to be done very careful. I reckon there ain't one boy in 1,000, maybe 2,000, that can do it the way it's got to be done. No, is that so? Oh, come now, let me just try, only just a little. I'd let you if you was me, Tom.
That bit of psychology was used by Tom Sawyer in the book by Mark Twain. But the author could be you. The Author Is You, a Wisconsin School of the Air series about the process of writing creatively. To conduct today's program, The Doctor Is In, here's Jacqueline Jackson.
Whether you've read the book or not, I bet you all know the story of Tom whitewashing the fence, or rather, not whitewashing the fence. How does he manage to get his friends to do it? He pretends that he wants to, that it takes special expertise, that they aren't good enough. He makes it desirable, and so he is able to spend the afternoon with his friends whitewashing the fence while Tom enjoys their company and their bribes to let him do it. He's understanding human nature. He's using psychology. Now, Tom didn't know that word around 1840, which was the time of the story of Tom Sawyer, Mark Twain's boyhood. And Elspeth, our daughter, when she was 4 or 5, didn't know that word when she climbed into her daddy's lap and said, "Do you like he's best or she's? I like he's," and rubbed her face all over his cheek. But Tom knew how to use psychology, and Elspeth knows how to use psychology. However, by the time that she's as old as Tom, she's going to know that word, and she's going to know a lot of other ones that Tom didn't know, and that I didn't know either when I was that age. Neurosis, adjustment, regression, subconscious, ego, inferiority complex, compensation, overcompensation, aggressive drive, and a lot more vocabulary that comes with a knowledge of psychological states. Kids these days know these words and know something about the meanings of these words because it's in the air. You hear about them in TV and in the movies and in the magazines. Read any cartoon section of the funny papers and you'll see jokes about it. I tore one out of the paper the other day. It shows a little boy sitting in his bed looking sort of ruefully at his father who is sitting on the edge of the bed, and the boy is saying, "But on the other hand, when Mom yells at me, it releases her hostilities and seems to clear up her sinus cavities." And then it's in the newspapers, in the Landers columns and the Dear Abby's columns, and in the sections that say, "Let's Explore Your Mind" by Dr. So-and-so, psychologist or psychiatrist. And it's mentioned in conversations. It's in the slang. You know about hang-ups, and you hear about being uptight. And we got a letter recently in a group of letters from children to practice teachers, telling them what sort of teachers that they would like in the school. And one kid finished his letter, I think he was about a third grader, "When you're teaching, don't let go of your string and quit, like Miss So-and-so did. Hang on." Now, talking about don't let go of your string, I think when we were younger, this was called going off the deep end. losing control, going to pieces. But it's a sort of current slang, and I can picture several sorts of things. Let go of your string, your balloon flies off, or your kite disappears. Or it could be a string of some sort of bag, and you let go of that string, and everything comes pouring out. It's a sort of a losing, disintegration figure. I don't know quite where it came from, if it's referring to a specific string or not. The way these things are in the air was illustrated in a Peanuts cartoon of quite a few years ago. Charlie Brown and Schroeder are walking along, and Schroeder says, "Remember how kids used to make lemonade stands? I wonder why you don't see them so much anymore. What's taken their place?" And just then they go past Lucy, who is at her little stand that looks like a lemonade stand, but it has psychiatric help, 5 cents on the top, and down below the doctor is, and then the square that says in. And in the final picture, Schroeder and Charlie are still walking along, and Charlie says, "Now you know." Peanuts is full of psychology and discussion of psychology. Here's another one from about that same vintage. Schroeder is talking to Lucy, and he says, "Why should I give you something for Beethoven's birthday? I don't even like you." He walks away, and Charlie Brown comes up and stands behind Lucy. Lucy turns around and says to Charlie Brown, "Well, I don't like you either." Whereupon Charlie, left standing alone, looks bewilderedly out at the reader and says, "I don't even know what's going on." That's the syndrome of kicking the next guy when you get kicked. It is, alas, human nature. And the understanding of that human nature is psychological understanding. And the thing that's funny about Lucy being in the psychologist's booth, the psychiatrist's booth that looks like a lemonade stand, is that a psychiatrist is supposed to be an understanding and helpful sort of person. He's supposed to help you see your problems more clearly and to understand yourself. And the joke is that crabby and self-centered Lucy is the last one you'd expect to have that sort of sympathetic understanding. When Linus says to Charlie Brown that he thinks that Sally is in need of help, that this fear that she has of starting kindergarten is beyond the normal fears of preschool children, Charlie Brown says, "Perhaps you're right." And then in the next picture, you see that the professional help is Lucy in her psychiatric booth, and Sally says, sitting in front of it, "My problem is I'm afraid of kindergarten. I don't even know why. I try to reason it out, but I can't. I'm just afraid. I think about it all the time. I'm really afraid." And then Lucy says, "You're no different from anyone else. 5 cents, please." Or Charlie is sitting in front of the stand, and he says, "I should have come to see you earlier this morning, but..." Lucy interrupts, "But you have iatrophobia, don't you? That's a fear of going to the doctor. I'll bet you have iatrophobia. What a terrible thing. You could have been here being cured of all your problems, but your iatrophobia kept you from coming. What a terrible thing." And Charlie finishes saying, "Actually, my mother wanted me to stay home and clean my room." Now, sometimes Lucy does show understanding, some insight. The times I've found, though, it's insight into her own psychology and not into the person that she's treating. Her booth has on it, in one particular cartoon, holiday rates. And she's been being really nasty to Charlie Brown. And Charlie says, "You sure are a crabby psychiatrist." And Lucy snarls back, "Well, we doctors have our post-Christmas letdowns, too." And then you've all seen the cartoons about Linus's security blanket, how Lucy buries it, how she makes a kite out of it, how she cuts it up for doll clothes, how Linus's blanket-hating grandma comes and all the traumas connected with that, how Snoopy grabs it regularly. Well, there's other places besides Peanuts that kids today are directly hearing about psychology. One of my favorite books, as you know, is Harriet the Spy. And that's built all around a psychological problem. She's a neglected rich kid. Her security is in her nurse and in her notebook. She loses her nurse and makes a sort of adjustment to that situation until she also loses her notebook. And then she lets go of her string. And the result is that the parents get her to a child psychiatrist near the end of the book, whom she views with considerable suspicion. What's he sitting around all day playing with kids' toys for, a grown man like him? But she humors him, and the situation works out. There's another book called The Teddy Bear Habit by James Lincoln Collier, and this boy's teddy bear is his Linus's security blanket. He's auditioning for a TV show. He's a New York kid who's in the talent market, and he's carried a paper bag with him by mistake into the audition. He was going to leave it right in the wings. Of course, there were no sneakers in it. There was no towel or no gym shorts either. What I had in the bag was a worn-out, beat-up, patched old teddy bear with one of its glass eyes missing and the threads that made up its mouth mostly rubbed away. It was a little smaller than a football, and I'd owned it all my life. It was as old as I was, older even, because it must have been made sometime before I was born. The truth is, I don't own it. It owns me. The thing is, I discovered a long time ago that I wasn't so much of a loser when I had the teddy bear around. It's magical. For example, that time I goofed up in the spelling bee. If I'd had the teddy there where I could have gotten a look at him, I wouldn't have goofed. I would have gotten nervous, maybe, but I probably would have got the answer right. I don't understand it. I just feel stronger and more confident when he's around. He's nothing but some cloth and a lot of old cotton batting. There shouldn't be any magic in that, but there is. Of course, a lot of the time, the teddy doesn't do me any good. I can't take the teddy into a basketball game with me, and I can't smuggle him into school when I have to say a poem I've memorized. But, for example, I had to be one of the wise men in the Christmas pageant last year and sing a song and all that jazz. I hid the teddy in this box of frankincense I was supposed to be carrying. I did my song perfectly. I was a big hit. Well, later in the book, he gets a job playing the guitar and singing, and he hides his teddy inside the guitar. And the crisis comes when the group that has hired these kids to perform decides that they will do it on those flat electric guitars that don't have any holes inside them. And so all of a sudden, here he is, left without his security teddy bear. And the story develops on how he finally manages to free himself and to have enough confidence that he can get along without his teddy bear. An understanding of why people behave the way they do and why you yourself behave the way you do is a very helpful thing. You'll be more sympathetic, maybe. Or if not, you'll at least be understanding. In that kick-the-next-guy syndrome, you'll realize that your big brother took it out on you because somebody else took it out on him, and so you took it out on the dog. By understanding psychology, you might be able to get rid of some things, like your unreasonable fears. It can be helpful in getting a small child to bed. If you have to put your little brother or sister to bed some night, it's much easier to use a little psychology to get him happily to bed than to carry him kicking or screaming. You can use it, of course, to manipulate people, and that's not good on the whole. You might say Tom Sawyer used it to manipulate his friends into painting that fence for him. I don't think that's necessarily bad in that case. The friends enjoyed it, Tom enjoyed it, Aunt Polly got her fence painted, and there didn't seem to be any harm done. But if you know something about psychology, you'll be able to tell more readily when somebody is trying to manipulate you or when you are using it to manipulate somebody, and this could be in a harmful sort of way. Today I thought it would be fun to write about the times where we've been aware of psychology, where maybe we've used it on somebody and it's worked, or it hasn't, how I used psychology to get out of something. You might try when my mother or my teacher or father or brother tried to use psychology on me, but I caught on. When psychology helped me, when it backfired. You might take a point of psychological understanding. Megan one time shrilled out, "I'm the middle sister, and everybody knows that the middle sister has the most troubles." What sort of advantages or disadvantages do you think your place in the family gives to you? What about being the oldest? What about being a middle child, a last child? the upper half of the lower half of the family, which was my position. You might try writing about something I can't get along without. Do you have a security blanket? Do you have a teddy bear habit? You might tell when you gave it up. When did you stop sucking your thumb and why? You may have some fears. Perhaps not iatrophobia, fear of going to the doctor, but you might be afraid of the dark or small spaces or great spaces. Do you know why? How did you get over that fear? I have a friend who never puts on a pair of pajamas without shaking it thoroughly and looking down all the sleeves, because once he put them on in a rural setting, a camping setting, and there was a spider in his pajamas. Now, even in the most domestic sort of setting, where a spider would never get into a pair of pajamas, he goes through this routine of shaking out pajamas and examining them for spiders. A final Peanuts cartoon, someone is saying to Lucy, who's in tears, "Please don't cry, Lucy." And Lucy snarls back at them, "What do you mean, don't cry? Why should I deprive myself of an emotional outlet?" Crying can help, but writing is less damp. So let's try giving ourselves an emotional outlet as well as a literary or a creative outlet by writing about our experiences with psychology or psychological understanding. And if you don't think of something right off, don't let go of your string. Think a few minutes, and I'm sure that you too have used or been used by psychology.
This has been a program in the creative writing series, The Author Is You, conducted today by children's author Jacqueline Jackson. This is Ken Ost for the Wisconsin School of the Air.